This is the Get Healthy 360 podcast, where we discuss topics related to your physical, mental, psychological, and spiritual health. Your host is Dr. Chris Ferguson, board certified in anesthesiology and pain management. This podcast is for informational purposes only, and you should consult your primary healthcare provider before making any decisions related to your health. And here's your host, Dr. Chris Ferguson.
So hello, today we are really lucky to have Dr. Jennifer Weiss on the podcast. She is a pediatric orthopedic surgeon. Jennifer, Dr. Weiss, can you talk to me about what does it mean to be a pediatric orthopedic surgeon? How does someone become a pediatric orthopedic surgeon?
Yeah, you got it. So thank you for having me. So fun to get acquainted with you from so many miles away. So a pediatric orthopedic surgeon, what that means is that I trained as an orthopedic surgeon, and I'll kind of explain what that meant. And then I did an extra year with kids, which was a fellowship year. And as if that weren't subspecialized enough, then I did some extra time with a pediatric sports expert team at the Children's Hospital Boston, which is the Harvard group, to do pediatric sport. So I'm a glutton for punishment and a lot of training.
So let's pretend that you're talking to like your 13 or 12 year old self. Yeah. And you're listening to this podcast and you want to get started. So you go into high school. Like, spell out the path.
I'll go back even further than that. So when I was in kindergarten, my kindergarten teacher, Mrs. Griffiths, said, Jennifer, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I said, and you haven't met me in person, but I'm 6 feet tall. So I said, I'm going to be a ballerina and I'm going to be an orthopedic surgeon. And she kind of chuckled and didn't think either one of them probably were going to happen. So flash forward. You know, finished high school, went to college. And for me in college, so most doctors, when they're in college, have to spend most of their time doing a bunch of science. I was really lucky. I went to a college, it's called Williams College, and we had a program that was created on the East Coast with my medical school, which is called Mount Sinai School of Medicine. It's in New York City. And they did this program where they took people and said, you get to major in whatever you want, and then you'll come spend your summers with us on our campus and take the fancy science stuff. So I was an art history major at a small liberal arts school, and then I went to Mount Sinai. And so when I started medical school, I was pretty convinced I was to become a pediatrician. I loved kids. And my dad was an orthopedic surgeon. That's why I told my teacher when I was in kindergarten something so random as I would be an orthopedic surgeon. So I said to my father, you know what, Dad, fine, I'll go to medical school, but I'm not going to be a surgeon. He's like, okay. And so I went and did my rotations. And in third year of medical school, we do rotations and actually get to test out all the different specialties. And we get graded on how well we do. So I did my pediatrics rotation, and it was not my vibe. I loved the kids. I loved a lot of the things about it, but I was really antsy to use my hands and to be out and about and up and around much more than my experience in that particular pediatric rotation in New York City. So then when I did my surgical rotation, I called my dad. I said, fine, I'm going to be a surgeon, but I'm not going to be an orthopedic surgeon like you. And he said, okay, fine. So I did my surgery rotation, loved it. And then at the end, we had to do an elective. So I did my orthopedic surgery elective, which was only 2 weeks, and I fell head over heels in love. So then I applied for orthopedic residency, and I did that. That was a...
So just pause right there. So for people who are listening, orthopedic surgery is a highly competitive, very male-dominated field. So of the orthopedic surgeons, how many of them are women?
So we are, of the practicing board-certified orthopedic surgeons in the United States, 6% of us are women. Of the residents, we're up to about 15%. So we're moving in the right direction, but we're moving way slower than I want us to move. If you were to be a fly on the wall of an orthopedic meeting, for instance, that I went to yesterday, all of the chiefs of the orthopedics departments in my organization, there were 22 people there. Two of us were women. So that's what the room looks like.
So pause again. And sometimes I'll interrupt for my own purposes. So when people hear about residency, I don't think they realize, or a lot of people don't realize, the rigor of residency. So more recently, there's the 80-hour work week, which technically means that in a given week, as a medical resident, meaning you've finished medical school and you're training to be a specific type of doctor, it's almost like your trade to be a doctor, you're limited to 80 hours per week. So you cannot work more than 80 hours per week. So really let that sink in, meaning you're going for a long period of time without sinking. Now, before this 80-hour work week started, there was no cap on working. Right. So as a resident, how many hours were you putting in?
Yeah, 110 plus. We do the math and then we forget about it for a while because it's so ridiculous, and then we do it again. My typical week as a resident, I did my residency at Baylor, which is in Houston, Texas, and I was the last group to go through pre-80-hour work week. The 80-hour work week hit when I was in my last year.
How sad were you?
Oh my gosh. It was crazy because not only did I not get it, but then all of the classes ahead of me, by the time they became a chief resident, their call diminished tremendously. But ours did it because we had to help the people younger than us. So sure. I got it on both ends. That being said, my typical week was I would go into the hospital at around 5 in the morning. We did not have great electronic medical records at that time, so there was a lot of work in just gathering up information from the nurses and how are the patients doing overnight. So really early in the morning. And then I would typically, so if it was Monday, I would get there at around 5. And then I would be on call Monday night.
So what does on call mean for the people that don't know what being on call means?
On call is like an evil form of torture for people. So I guess the flip side, although I just said that snarkily, is that means that anybody in our country who really needs a doctor is going to find a doctor, because there are doctors that are on duty, that are on call, that are immediately available to help patients that are sick or hurt or whatever it is. So that altruistic side of me says isn't that great. But my 25-year-old self that was doing this through my 30-year-old self, what that would mean is the majority of the team, of the resident team, would go on home, and then one poor soul would hang around with a beeper. And believe it or not, I still have a beeper in 2018, which is very special for me. So I used to carry around like 3 beepers, because there was my beeper, there was the orthopedic beeper for the emergency room, there was a different beeper for the operating room if they needed me. So all these beepers slung along my scrubs on my hip. And so that, on a typical night in our county hospital, which was the hospital that thankfully took care of anybody who could pay or not pay, they could come to this hospital and get their care. So that place, it was very rare if you got to put your head down for an hour.
So I'm gonna even clarify this a little bit more. So you would get there 5 o'clock in the morning, and then you would work all day, and then people would give you their patients to cover, and then you would work all night.
Yes.
And then what time would you leave the next day?
Around 5 p.m.
So I'm going to really emphasize this point. So you're getting there, say, 5 a.m. Monday, work all day Monday. Do you get to eat? Did you ever eat? How much did you eat?
You know what? I will tell you, I was an eater. I always figured out a way to eat. I was the person who carried snacks in my pocket. I would sneak out and eat like half a bar or candy bar. Yeah, I ate.
So I'm making this point clear, because anyone who hasn't experienced it, it's not really clear, because you think you get a lunch, but unlike other professions, you don't stop. Like, you go, you're just going the whole time. There's no hour brunch or lunch or anything. Like, you're going the whole time. So you get there Monday morning, you're seeing patients, going to the operating room, doing whatever it is doctoring you're doing, and then you're there all night. Not sleeping, you're working the whole time up until 5 the next morning. So it's 5 a.m. Tuesday now. You're still working, doing things. And then all day Tuesday you're working, and then you don't go home until 5 p.m. Friday night.
Well, Tuesday, because we started Monday.
Tuesday. I'm sorry. Yeah. So you start Monday, and then you work all day, and then you leave Tuesday afternoon. So what would be interesting for me is you'd have nursing staff come in, and they'd be bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, say Monday morning, you're there, and then you're working, and then they will go home and sleep and do whatever it is they do. but you're still there all night, and then you come back the next morning, and then they're like, they come back in and they're like, oh, hey, you don't look so great.
That's true. And it's funny because the relationships ranged. Like, there were some very kind, amazing nurses, and there were also some really mean nurses. And the thing that was a bummer for me, being one of the first ways I recognized that my climb was going to be a little bit more uphill than my male counterparts was, so most of my male counterparts, like in my residency program in Texas, were all these nice looking young men. And then here I would come along. So not only was I not a nice looking young man for them to flirt with, I was also their competition, or at least they thought so. So there were definitely some nurses that were extra mean to me. I won a lot of them over by trying to be nice, but that was always really hard when I was sleep deprived and there would be some nurses that would be not so kind to me. That was sad.
So, and then some people will think, well, okay, you finished medical school, you should be making some ridiculous amount of money. But when you work out what you're paid and then per hour, I think it probably works out to like $2 an hour.
Oh, it was so sad. We did the math at one point. Yeah, really, really little money. I was so fortunate that my parents helped me through residency. My dad was an orthopedist, and my mom talks about when my dad was a resident, and they had us then. I was single in residency with no kids, but my mom would bring us up on mac and cheese and, you know, whatever vegetables she could scrounge up. It is not a high paying time of life for medical professionals.
And then this was before the Me Too moment and a lot of political correctness. So do you want to comment on that as well?
Yeah, I sure can. So it's interesting. I am the sort of person that always says, lucky me. You know, I got through it without, you know, X, Y, and Z. The fact is, there was a woman who was 4 years ahead of me who was amazing. And then there was a woman who was 3 years behind me who I have reconnected with recently, because although I knew she was amazing, the two of us really didn't connect. My only colleagues who were women that were my peers were women that were surgeons training in other specialties. I was really lucky to have some friends who were head and neck surgeons training. And my best friend at the time was training to be an OBGYN, delivering babies, things like that. That was really probably much harder than I let myself know at that time. Recently, I've connected with a number of women in my field who are of color, so underrepresented minority women. And I don't know what it's like to walk in their shoes. So I've been really doing a lot of questioning about what does that feel like. And one of them sent me a message recently. She said, Jen, you know what? Sometimes I just feel invisible. And I thought, that describes a lot of what I felt at that time, at that place. That the invisibility of not being part of this group. There were definitely some aggressive moves that were worse. Thankfully not physical, some aggressive emotional stuff. But the worst part was the invisibility. These guys, there were some great guys who I'm still very close with, but the culture was that the male surgeons on the night that they might have off, so, you know, they're leaving at 5 or 6 at night and they might not have to be back until 5 the next morning. They would go to strip clubs. They would, you know, if it were daytime event, I'm not a hunter. They might go hunting. They might play golf. I'm not a golfer. And then they would go to strip clubs. So it was just, I was invisible from that whole world. And that was, it could feel pretty lonely at times.
Well, I would think it would take a lot of emotional strength to get through something like that, because often it helps to rely on other people to get through it. But if you're not bonding with the people that you're training with, there really, I would guess, is not a lot of other people, because you're just at work all the time.
Yeah, I'm really, really lucky. There was a man who graduated a year ahead of me and one who graduated 2 years behind me who I was so close with, and they were so supportive. And both of their wives, because they were both married as residents, were also my people and very supportive. I'm not sure if they didn't exist, if how it would have all gone for me. And some of the other people were very, very good to me, but still had that veneer of invisibility about me. But these two guys made it so I could breathe.
So you get through, so you finish undergrad, you get through medical school, which is 4 years, and then orthopedic surgery is how long?
So it's 5 years for the residency.
And then after the residency, how did you decide to go into pediatrics? Was it just because you like the kids, or physically it was lighter? I'm just imagining kids are easier to operate on than adults.
No, so there's some interesting things about it. I didn't call it out at the time, but now I understand that. So, you know, I'm 47. So at that time, what we're now 6%, we were about 3% women. I had about, my role models were about 3% women. And actually, I have to pause for 1 second to say I had one of the best role models that I could ask for. I did not have any women at my actual home-based program in orthopedics as attendings, which are the people who oversee the residents' work. However, there were 3 women that I interacted with on rotations that were away from my home base. One was a pediatric orthopedist whose name is Allison Scott, a wonderful woman, a mom. She was very, very supportive. And then there were 2 women that were tumor surgeons. So they were, if orthopedics is kind of badass, they're badass of the badass. And one of them is named Valerie Lewis, and she is the chief of orthopedic oncology at MD Anderson in Houston still, an amazing woman. The other was Christy Weber, who in March of 2019 will become the first woman president of the Orthopedic Academy. And so I got to meet her when I was a resident, and I knew it was really special to have her in my life, but flash forward all these years, I'm on the board of directors with her. She's going to be the president. It's just, it was so influential for me to have her. So sorry, I strayed from your question. So the reason I think I became a pediatric orthopedist is multifold. One was, I think that there were more women in pediatric orthopedics than other orthopedic fields. Number 2, I think the size of the patients, you're absolutely right, was less daunting in terms of the physicality. But the other thing about pediatric orthopedics that I found really interesting was you could still be a generalist, meaning you could be a doctor that took care of a lot of different problems, but you could do it on kids or with kids or for kids, as opposed to the other specialties, which were you focused on the hand or you focus on the hip and the knee replacement. So for me, I thought I liked the anatomy of being able to do surgeries all over the body. That was the story I told myself then, but now I really understand that I think it's those other 2 things that I wasn't as aware of at the time.
So out of curiosity, I think part of it is, I don't know if this would resonate with you, is some adults are jerks. Like they're jerks.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of reasons they are not the most pleasant people. They may have had bad backgrounds, whatever it is, but they're just not pleasant. Whereas it's really difficult not to just feel bad for a child that has broken something.
Well, there's that. So I'm never mad at a child unless they are one of my 3 children who I do get mad at. But, no, you can't be mad at kids. And also kids want to get better. Now, most adults want to get better too, but there's a lot of secondary gains.
Well, it's interesting because I have a lot of psychologists that are going to be on the podcast, and I've had a lot of psychological conversations. And there's a whole subset of people that, for a variety of reasons, do not want to get better.
Right.
They just don't. They really don't. And that's a whole other conversation of why they don't want to get better. But I totally agree with you. Kids, as a whole, as a general rule, want to get better. And they're happy to see you, as a general rule.
That's beautiful because, they're a great partner. And I think that medicine in 2018, we really recognize that for patients to get better, they have got to be on the team, and they're the most important member of the team to get better. And kids are good at that.
So how long was the pediatric subspecialty?
Right. So that was a fellowship, Los Angeles, which was just, it's an amazing place.
Wait, how long was the fellowship? You cut out for a second. How long was the fellowship?
1 year.
Okay.
1 year.
So to get into your day-to-day practice, so what are some of the things, common injuries that you would see that you think this could be prevented?
Right. So preventable injuries, the most common preventable break is of the elbow in kids. And the most common way that kids break their elbow is the monkey bars. And then the second really device that is responsible for a lot of broken children is a trampoline. And that goes for also like the trampoline kind of establishments that are all over the country now, the Sky Highs and the Dojo Booms and all of these places where people go and jump on super trampolines.
Oh, wait, I just bought him. I have a little 17-month-old. I just bought him a little baby trampoline.
Fabulous.
Should I get rid of that?
So here's the thing about me. If you Google me, you'll find me talking a lot about how trampolines are dangerous, and you'll also find some articles that I've written about it. And then if you look in my backyard, you will find a large trampoline that often has all three of my children doing flips on it. So I'm very much talking out of both sides of my mouth and a hypocrite. The reason I have a trampoline and I let my kids on it is that for me, I don't wrap my kids in bubble wrap, and I try to follow the rules of how to keep them as safe as possible. But we do believe that under the age of six and below, and this doesn't go for those little kid trampolines, but the big kind of trampolines, we do recommend, our Pediatric Orthopedic Society recommends, that kids under the age of seven, so six and below, probably are not supposed to use trampolines. The hypocrite in me will admit that all of my children...
I have to get rid of the trampoline now?
So I have one, and I had one before my kids were of the age that they're supposed to use it. The injuries that kids tend to get tend to be fixable. And most of the time when they injure themselves, it's because they are on the trampoline with different sized kids and they are not supervised. So if a child is on the trampoline by themselves and doing reasonable things, the odds of them getting hurt are very low.
So are the collisions because kids are bouncing into each other?
Yes. And so old school, I already told you how old I am. So when I was growing up, a trampoline did not have a net around it, had a bunch of springs on it, and kids would like bounce themselves, like they're doing this thing called double bouncing, where you would actually fly off of the trampoline and often land on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So those were even more dangerous. Our studies actually don't show that the netting helps that much, but having the lack of those big springs does help, because those would be the cause of insult to injury and scrapes and all of those sorts of things. There's also in-ground trampolines that are supposed to be a little bit safer, but it's really about the safety of the children and not having them collide into one another.
From what I'm hearing, it's a lot safer just to have one child on the trampoline at a time.
Correct, but they think that's boring, so you have to battle that.
Sure. And then someone was telling me the other day, you shouldn't really be swinging little kids by their arms.
Yeah. So you know what you can do with that? If you swing a kid by their hand, if you swing them anywhere distal to their elbow, which means in regular language, anywhere between where their elbow and their hand are, in a small child, especially your kid's age at 17 months, you can actually pull part of the elbow apart. So the doctor term for it is a radial head subluxation.
That's really a fancy term for lay people.
It's very fancy. It's also called a nursemaid's elbow. And so if you pick a kid up by their hands or their wrists and swing them around, you can do that. So we don't recommend that.
So what happens if that happens? So say because I know not to do it, but let's say someone picks up their child by, say, their forearms and swings them, because the kid's loving it and the kid's laughing.
Yep.
Spell that out. What will that injury look like?
So if they get a nursemaid's elbow by somebody swinging them around by their hands or their forearms, they will cry and they will not move their arm. And the way that the doctor approaches that or fixes that is by a maneuver where you make the palm of the hand face the upper arm and you bend it up. And that clicks it back into place. It does not feel better immediately, and the kid will still be really grouchy for about a half hour or 45 minutes, but will slowly recognize that their elbow is back in place and go back to their business.
Is that a permanent injury, or is that...
Not okay. Permanent. It's okay. Totally fixable, but they hate it. It's sad for them.
And I'm going to be really clear. You need a physician to do that. If anyone's listening to this, do not do this on your own unless you are a qualified physician.
That's correct. And one caveat I'll say is that if some children are prone to it and have it happen over and over, So your doctor may teach you how to do the maneuver and tell you in a very specific way how you could do it by yourself, but only after being taught and educated by your doctor.
How old are the kids that you see? Like, what are the, is it from like really young all the way up?
So my practice actually is I see them into their young adult years. And when I'm on call, I even take care of adults. However, most pediatric orthopedists go up to the age of about 16. The age where kids' growth plates, like the areas where the bone grows, that normally turns into the similar to an adult bone somewhere between the age of 14 and 16.
I'm just going to go through some really common sports, and then I'm looking to you to give advice. So what would you say about, like, say, ballerinas or cheerleaders, gymnasts?
Yeah. Okay. So first of all, I will tell you, I am not sure who has a higher pain tolerance, football players or ballerinas or dancers. And cheerleaders and gymnasts kind of fit into that, too.
Did you ever become a ballerina? Because that was the other thing you said you wanted to be.
No, I did not. But my two daughters dance all the time, and they are tough as nails. One thing that dancers, ballerinas specifically, they can hurt their hips because the way they dance with their feet turned out can be very irritating to the hip socket. So they can tear things up in their hips. Their toes just get really nasty if they go on point. They get bunions, they get all sorts of toe awesome shape changes, which in doctor speak we call deformity. Those are the most common for the ballerinas. They can also get, we all have, or a lot of us have, this extra little bone behind our heel, and most of us don't notice it or care about it, but ballerinas, if they're up on their toes, they can kind of squish that bone in there, so sometimes they'll get special heel pain too.
Anything preventative, any of those gymnast ballerinas can do?
So the core strengthening is so important. So if somebody's training seriously to be at any of those things, their coach or studio or teacher will be very, very good about core strengthening. But there are some people who are doing this recreationally who don't strengthen themselves enough in their core, and that will lead to a lot of aches and pains, and they can get irritation in their joints. So the core strengthening is really important.
Suggestions for, say, football or hockey?
Yeah. So anything that is a full-on collision sport, like football or hockey or lacrosse, men's lacrosse, those have a higher risk of concussion, which is an injury to the head. However, we now know that soccer also has a really high risk of concussion. So the controversy as to whether American football is safe for anybody of any age, but particularly for kids who are in my population, is really alive and well. And I take care of football players all the time. I have no judgment about it. But I will tell you, my 7-year-old, who is a giant of a boy and is a really good athlete, he's playing flag football, but he will not be allowed to play tackle football.
Are there any sports you would not let your son play?
Yeah. So he's not going to be allowed to play tackle football. He is not going to be allowed to play ice hockey. I actually played lacrosse growing up, and I really loved the sport. But I've got concerns about lacrosse as well. He doesn't really know what that is yet, so I might get off scot-free about that one.
What would you say about boxing?
Yeah, boxing I would not let him do. It's interesting. There's a lot of women boxing now. It's such a great workout. But yeah, no one in my house is going to be allowed to do contact boxing.
What about mixed martial arts or Brazilian jiu-jitsu?
Yeah. Mixed feelings about that, but probably not in my household. And again, I don't judge people who are doing it.
Sure.
I think the martial arts are, there's so much mind body about it. As you told me, you're going to be interviewing psychiatrists and psychologists.
Yep.
So I won't get to it, but I'm really into the mind body stuff. And so anything that allows kids to start to develop in that way, I'm going to be supportive of.
No, anything that you want to add, I think would be really interesting from an orthopedic standpoint.
Yeah, and I think one of the interesting things taking care of adolescent athletes is we have to be aware of all of the great things that sports bring to the development of our youth. And being a woman, especially to young women, learning to be successful on a team, learning confidence, all of those things, I can't say enough great things about.
Okay, so you've ruled, you're not a fan of hockey, football, soccer because of the concussions.
Yeah, although I didn't tell you, though, that I wouldn't let my kids play soccer. They do play soccer. And it's stupid because they can get concussed that way, too. Again, I'm a hypocrite. I told you that.
That's okay. And then, what are the most common injuries you actually see with those sports, other than the concussions?
Yeah, so lots of ACL tears, anterior cruciate ligament. So that's the connection from the thigh bone to the shin bone that keeps your knee stable. And young athletes in any sort of cutting and pivoting sport, meaning they're changing directions, they can tear their ACL, and girls do it more than boys, actually.
Any comments on stem cell treatment?
Yeah, jury's still out. I think we're going to find evidence at some point for this, but the jury's still out on the evidence of it. So right now, there's not great evidence that it's helpful with anything that's actually torn or broken.
What about platelet-rich plasma?
Yeah, the same. There are some studies that suggest that platelet-rich plasma, which is PRP, or you might have heard of it as spun-down cells, that might be helpful for something called tendonitis, which is when something gets one of your tendons, which is a connection between bones. It gets used a lot. It gets irritated and inflamed. And there's some evidence to say that PRP can be helpful for that, but I think we're going to learn a lot about this in the next 5-10 years.
So this is going to be a little bit more of a technical comment. What's interesting is I was talking to another physician about the platelet-rich plasma. If you spin down your blood to get out the platelets, if you remove the white blood cells are what cause a lot of inflammation. So if you remove those, and it's the technical term would be leukocyte-reduced platelet-rich plasma or platelet-rich plasma without these white cells, the healing factors tend to work a lot better.
Yeah. It's all interesting in theory.
But it's all theory, I know.
Yeah. Just hasn't borne out yet. I'm excited because I think it will, but impatient because it hasn't.
Yes. And then what about wrestling injuries?
Yeah, wrestling injuries. Wrestlers definitely tear themselves up. Well, they break bones, definitely. And they tend to tear their soft tissues in different ways. It's less common for a wrestler to tear their anterior cruciate ligament, more common for them to tear the soft tissues that line their knees and shoulders, called the labrum and the meniscus.
So of all the kids that you see that play sports, who gets injured the most?
Gymnasts and football players.
And how do the gymnasts get injured?
They fall and break themselves.
So how often do they go back into gymnastics training?
You know, there's two other ways that gymnasts get hurt. One common one is overuse of their elbows, and they can hurt their cartilage, which is kind of the lining of their bones of their elbows. And they also sometimes will get back injuries from hyperflexing, so that leaning back motion that they do a little bit aggressively in a lot of their tumbling and apparatus movement. So gymnasts are the fiercest. I mean, once they are at a level of gymnastics where they are doing their thing 14 hours or more per week, it is really hard to get them to leave it. There's also a thing where we as surgeons will remind them that there's a sport called diving. So that a lot of them that have just gotten to this level of expertise and can't leave that behind, but pounded themselves too much, will be convinced to go into diving. But those kids are addicted, and they are so fiercely loyal to their sport.
How hard is it for them to train? It seems like it'd be a natural progression, but how hard is it mentally for them to switch from gymnastics to diving?
Yeah, the couple that I've been successful with, diving is also a team sport. It's less common, and the facilities that you need to do it are less, or sort of fewer and further between. I'm in Los Angeles, so I think there's a bit of a mecca here for it. But it is interesting to get somebody to change sport and to leave. You know, they specialize so young today. So to leave their community is really can have an effect on them.
So do you have any advice for parents who are trying to pick a sport, or some parents just really want their kids hardcore in something, but any advice for that?
Yeah. So here's a couple of things we know. the longer you wait to let your child specialize, the more you let your child play different sports, the more you make sure your child rests at least a month per year from the sport that they are doing the most, and at least 2 to 3 days per week from that sport, the better off your child will be in terms of their body staying healthy. And also they tend to burn out mentally less. So cross training and lack of specialization at an early age are so important for the health of our athletes mentally and physically.
So what is your take on weightlifting? This is going to be a two-part question. Weightlifting for kids, and then this is going to be kind of a controversial question. CrossFit for kids.
Yeah. So weightlifting, when the growth plates are still open, so remember I told you around 14 to 16, those growth plates, the areas where the bone grows, those close down. After that, really anything goes. But before that, they should not be lifting more than 10 to 20% of their body weight. And that is so far off from what a lot of young, especially young men, are doing in their training. In terms of CrossFit, CrossFit is a real, it's amazing for a lot of people, amazing. But it is definitely an injury maker for people who are not really strict about their form. And younger people tend to not be as strict about their form. So I never say never, but if somebody is going to do some sort of CrossFit-like activity as a child or an adolescent, I'm very reliant on them having a coach that is all about their form and not overdoing it.
There's another thing I'm going to transition to, but any other closing thoughts on like athletes and kids and anything you'd want parents to know?
Yeah, I would just say I'm very proud of our society. I think we've come a long way in the last 5 to 10 years in terms of recognizing that we don't need to push our kids as hard.
I think that some people have recognized that they don't need to push their kids that hard. But I have many friends that are in family practice, and very often they're really pushed to clear kids for specific sports when really they really should not be cleared.
Yeah, that's sad that that's still hitting some pockets. I think also, as an orthopedist, I am not always as compassionate as maybe some of the doctors who have, you know, these kids and these families with these really long-term relationships. So I'm more stubborn, I think, about the clearance. And if they're grouchy about it, so be it. I always remind them that their child is most likely not getting a paycheck for their sport yet.
But I think a lot of parents really, that is their long-term plan for their child. Like, their child will go on and play a professional sport. And that's, I think some parents view that as that's their retirement. Like, they will facilitate their kids doing this particular sport, and then their kids will take care of them.
Yeah. And the fact is, the percentage amount of times that will actually work out is so low. It's just such a silly plan. And it's a sad plan.
I agree with you, because no one's probably going to be happy with that. There's going to be a lot of unhappiness. So being a doctor, and especially an orthopedic surgeon, I am sure there's these great moments of like a kid's playing a healthy sport and then they get injuries. But then there's kind of a darker side that I'm sure you see with child abuse issues.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, we as especially orthopedic educators are really always reminding every kind of healthcare professional about non-accidental trauma. And yeah, it is definitely the most devastating part of my career for me and all of my colleagues. And it happens. And I think that the ability to sit in a room with an adult that you believe might have hurt a child is the most challenging thing on the planet for me.
How good are you at just keeping your composure, especially if you know, like, you know, this adult did this?
Yeah. Yeah. So for me, my first 5 years of practice, I got in touch more with the anger. And I think I just feel so sorry for those people now that I've kind of turned to, probably worse for them to feel it, but I feel more pity than I do anger now. And I'm always shocked at how resilient children are. And it's just so amazing to me how, you know, when they're survivors of this behavior, you know, how they can bounce back and be part of the world and walk around in this world that's been so mean to them. It's crazy.
So you're mandated to notify authorities if you suspect child abuse. How often do you actually see that in your practice?
A couple of times a year. And I work in a big organization. So for me, in my organization, it is pick up the phone and call our social work team, who really does the heavy lifting with the reporting and all of that. But for my colleagues who are out there in private practice, needing to do this themselves, it's so sad and it's also so cumbersome. And the role that the physicians need to play as this plays out is really hard because you don't get compensated for your time while you're, filling out this paperwork or perhaps being interviewed in a deposition. And our society really relies on physicians' expertise in this. Yet a physician, let's say you're in private practice, you're a single doctor in what we call solo practice, and you need to take your time to help this child. It's our system is not well set up because that doctor can't really pay the bills for those hours that they're needing to do this work, right?
So just to expand on that, so if a doctor's in private practice, they see a child that they suspect has been the victim of abuse, if they're filling out quite a bit of paperwork or dealing with police officers, et cetera, they still have to pay all their staff because all their staff gets paid regardless. They have to pay their rent. They have to pay for all these other things. So if you really think about it as a regular job, you have to do these things really for free to help this person out, which doctors do every day.
Yeah. Yeah, that's correct.
So do you want to comment, because there are going to be a lot of non-physicians listening to this, do you want to comment on some of the things that really people should look out for?
So first of all, a child who has an injury before the age where they can move around on their own, that's very suspicious. So a child can't really break themselves if they can't move. So that's one thing. Things like bruise marks that are in surrounding a limb. So that's that sort of the mark of grabbing. They're two of the signs that are pretty obvious. And I would also just say anything that just doesn't feel right. We can never go wrong by bringing whatever this feeling is that we have about a kid perhaps getting hurt. If we bring it to the attention of a teacher, they are mandated reporters. A doctor, they are mandated reporters. You can never go wrong by bringing that up because if it's investigated and found to be false, any family who cares about the well-being of children in this country and in this world, I think they're going to understand at some point if they were investigated and found to be not guilty, that's a sign that our system is hopefully picking up the guilty people. So that's the way I kind of look at it.
And then to move to a different topic. So right now there's the whole narcotic issue, opioid epidemic. So my background is in anesthesiology and pain management. Yeah. So what do you do for, say, post-op pain control?
Yeah. So there's new regulations about this, which are amazing. And I'm very, very, very happy with this. And the orthopedics the orthopedic community has been very involved in the opioid epidemic sort of toolkit, rule book, and all of this. So the law in California now is that I am not permitted to prescribe more than 5 days of narcotic medication for my patient without doing a check through a network on what their history is of narcotics. So our current practice is that our patients are getting fewer narcotics prescribed. And the thing that I think is really great is there was an era about 10 years ago where hospitals were asking us to promise a painless experience for patients. And it was really not feasible, and it created expectations for patients that pain meant something was wrong after surgery. Pain is going to happen after surgery, and if we develop a correct expectation surrounding the fact that there's going to be discomfort and even pain, the ability to get through the pain is so much better. And arming them with other techniques like breathing techniques, mindfulness, you know, different ways of approaching pain, so important. So yeah, the orthopedic community is really, really dedicated to not just decreasing the problem, but being part of the solution for this.
So as an orthopedic surgeon, what's your take on, like, say, ibuprofen? So in general, just for anyone who's listening, young children should not be given aspirin for a variety of reasons, but don't give your kids aspirin. But what's your take on ibuprofen and that drug class after a break? So what's your take on ibuprofen?
Sure. So there was a period of time where we thought that ibuprofen, or the whole class of medications that are called nonsteroidal anti-inflammatories, were bad for bone healing. But what we know now is that that's actually not the case. Lots of studies have been done and shown that they're actually fine. They do not delay or inhibit bone healing. And so we're using them in our armamentarium now perioperatively, meaning before and after surgery.
Okay. Any other advice for people who say their child broke their bone playing football or something?
I would say just recognize they're going to heal. They're going to get through this. They need you to be positive, and they need you to not be anxious, and they will model your behavior.
I am sure you love dealing with parents when they have a child that is injured. That's me being sarcastic. So what advice do you have for parents when, say, their kids break something? Like, loving, happy parents, their kids break something, they come to see you. What can they do to help their child the most?
Yeah, your kid's going to read your face. If you can breathe and be on the team of calm, your kid's going to follow suit. And it doesn't matter what age your kid, even babies, they sense it. So the calmer you are and the more relaxed and trusting you are in the environment, your child will come right along with you.
And that makes a lot of sense. I want to be respectful of your time. So any closing thoughts?
Yeah, no, this has been fun. And I hope people learn a little bit about the world of orthopedics from this time. And thank you for putting this out there for the world and letting people hear the words of doctors a little more.
So Dr. Jennifer Weiss, thank you so much for taking the time. I know you're very busy. Again, thanks very much.
Thank you so much. You have a great night.
You too.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe and visit the Get Healthy 360 Facebook page. We are always looking for feedback and new story ideas. Thanks again, and see you next time.